Hey everyone, I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Hello and welcome to Stage 9, Trek FM's show about the people who make Star Trek. I'm Mike.
I'm John.
And today we're joined by two very special guests, Zach from Standard Orbit.
Hello.
And Lee from Earl Grey.
Greetings, Q.
Thanks for joining us, guys. We're going to be talking about Tomorrow Never Dies today. But before we get into that, there's a lot of crazy news going on in the world of Star Trek Discovery. And it's probably going to be even more crazy news by the time this episode drops. But you know what? We're always behind because of our schedule. So we apologize. So let's get started with Brian Fuller, who made waves a couple weeks ago, I guess at this point, by saying that he's no longer involved with the production of Disco. So here's my question. What does that mean? And is it really any different from what was said like in late October? Zach, what do you think?
I don't think it's any different at all. I think people were under, you know, the false hope that, oh, well, he's going to be the executive producer, but his name will still be on it. And it's like, look, guys, Tim Burton was the executive producer on Batman Forever. Okay, so look at that, right? So that's how it works,
point.
Man. I'm not saying if that's good or bad. I'm just saying that that's a fact, and he was not involved. I see guys shaking their head. I see John shaking his head.
Yeah, I mean, no. I think that's an excellent point that you just made. So, it really is.
And it's also interesting that Akiva Goldsman is the person brought on to replace the person who's not involved with said production.
Yeah. You know, they've done some good stuff. He's done some good stuff on Fringe, and I was a big fan of that show, so that makes sense that they, you know, I guess, you know, the Kurtzman, the Star Trek family, the Bad Robot family, that all makes sense, but This to me is just more information of news we already had than like, oh, it's breaking news, he really is gone. I just think it's like, yeah, that's exactly what I figured his role would be, non-existent at this point. And it's disappointing because for so long he was on the top of everybody's list of like, oh, if they ever get another Star Trek show, we want Brian Fuller. And then we got Brian Fuller for, I don't know, like what, 3 or 4 months was it? And now he's gone. So it's like, oh, wow, it would have been better if he was just never involved from the start because we felt like our hopes were answered and then they were taken away. And now they're all, no matter how good or bad this show is, there'll always be that in the back of everybody's mind. Oh man, what would it have been like if Fuller would have stayed? And you know, that'll be one of the great unanswered questions of fandom for the rest of our Star Trek fandom, guys.
So Lee, do you agree with this assessment?
I said quite early on, I'm surprised it almost lasted this long because he had a hell of a lot on his plate early doors. He had the American Gods and a couple of other shows on the go at the same time. And I was like, well, he's kind of made Star Trek fit. And I knew, like, the other day when I saw the headline that, oh, God, here we go again. I remembered reading the article and I went, it's kind of nothing I didn't already know or suspect would happen. And that's perfectly okay and it's all pretty reasonable. And, yeah, it seems all amicable. No issue. We carry on. I'm kind of happy with the people that are involved. I see no reason to panic. I think the thing that kind of comes out of this and why kind of Stage 9 is so good, it's kind of almost fire control, is that I think a lot of people, you know, it's not through kind of ignorance, it's just kind of not knowing how kind of television actually works, and things like this are all too common, and the way this seems to have ended is 1,000 times better than a lot of other TV shows and throughout Trek history. That this idea that, oh, they still don't have a main actor or they still don't have certain things in place, I don't really see an issue. This show's not out till May. You know, TV production is relatively fast paced once it's up and going. They've probably well underway with construction of sets. Their set designs are probably all into place. I'm not concerned or worried. I'm perfectly happy, and I'm sure we're going to see Brian Fuller's influence regardless kind of all over that first few seasons in terms of characters, starting episodes, and kind of themes, so I'm pretty relaxed about it.
What do you think, John?
Yeah, I mean, I'm the outlier. I fell for it. I fell for the clickbait article, and, you know, like I read it, I was like, oh, no, because what I took it to mean was sort of, I guess, riffing on what you were saying, Zach, was like, I had in my head that, yeah, he was stepping back and Akiva Goldsman was in and everything like that. But he, you know, he'd be like just a phone call away if they needed him. So for him to say in no uncertain terms, I got zip to do with this. If they want me, you know, maybe they can call me back when I'm free. Like that, for me, gave it a new spin when I read it for the first time. But, you know, I sort of have since come around and realized that, yeah, you know, this is, you know, because he went on and he clarified and he said, I still wrote, you know, the arc, you know, I helped write the arc for the season and, you know, I pushed for certain characters to be in there. And so, yeah, his fingerprints are on it. He's just not going to be there, you know, day to day.
Yeah, I mean, I'm with you, John, in that I thought that, yeah, he would be there sort of being like, yeah, yeah. You know, I mean, it's one of those things where I didn't think that he was going to be there on a day-to-day basis. And I at the same time, I thought they'd be like, so we're thinking about casting Jug Jones. What do you think about that? And he'd be like, oh, that's cool, you know, that kind of thing. But it sounds like there is no involvement there. You know, I mean, and my first kind of clue that maybe this was the case actually came like a day or two before this article dropped when, you know, everyone in the world is tweeting about, you know, Doug Jones and Michelle Yeoh and Anthony Rapp. And then, you know, Brian Fuller is like, I'm in London watching Harry Potter and the Goblet of whatever the new play is called, you know,
cursed
and I'm
child,
like,
my cursed child.
Okay. Yeah. That thing. So I'm like, okay, he really does not seem to be interested in this Star Trek show anymore. And I guess, I mean, to me, while he isn't as active as I assumed he was, I didn't really think he was going to be that active. I mean, I really thought it was going to be the type of thing where, I mean, kind of like we've talked about, let's say JJ being active in Westworld or something like that, you know? Like, I don't think that he, once he stepped back, I don't think that his presence was necessarily needed. And if anything, you know, I'm okay with him leaving just so that whoever is there can do their thing, you know? So, I mean, I don't know. I don't really see this as being the end of the world. I definitely don't think it's as big news as him stepping down in the first place or anything like that. But it is interesting. And, you know, he has talked about it a little bit more. There's a new article on Digital Spy that came out the day that we're recording where he talks about how with Star Trek, ultimately, it was not being able to do what CBS needed to be done in the time they needed it done. Part of that was due to his responsibilities on American Gods, which he's very dedicated to, and blah, blah, blah. And then here he's saying, like, it was unfortunate to take a step back from that show, and mainly because of the opportunity that I believe that Star Trek provides for a conversation about progress for humanity and the planet and being able to tap into that. He says that this is the best path. And then here's the really interesting part. He's talking about, you know, American Gods. He says, Fuller further suggested that Star Trek is, quote, a religion-free show. The themes of faith and immigration in American Gods will make it, quote, resonant and present in 2016. And then he says, religion on the planet has kind of gone extinct in a way in Star Trek, and right now religion is feeding a lot of issues in many different ways. As an artist, I want to represent the times in which we are telling a story, and I feel like I have that opportunity with American Gods. So that's kind of interesting that, you know, even though Star Trek is his dream project and everything like that, you know, it sounds like some of the stuff which appeals to him in Star Trek thematically, he feels like he's able to tackle better in American Gods, you know? Interesting.
Yeah, for him to say that, I mean, he worked on Deep Space Nine. He knows that religion could be incorporated into Star Trek. So it's interesting, like, maybe like he was saying, the CBS would not allow him to do it. Maybe they thought that would be too controversial. That, you know, they're trying to, you know, the whole crux behind them making Star Trek Discovery is to launch their CBS All Access. So you don't want your flagship show of your new paid service to be some, like, polarizing, controversial product. So I can see why maybe he wanted to get deeper into stuff, and they're like, whoa, let's back off, let's keep it simple, let's stick to the 5-year mission, and, you know, let's keep it just to the basics and not go into this deep stuff. So that's very possible. And then, you know, maybe there's so many factors, and we'll never know the full story, and maybe we'll know in 25 years when somebody writes a memoir about this. But, you know, I think there's a lot of truth to what he said. I think there's a lot of stuff behind the scenes that we're not going to know about, like I just said. But I think he's making the most of it. Like, I don't think this is all just spin. I think that he is, okay, well, this is my situation now, so I'm going to embrace what's happened and move forward with this new project that I am excited about. So, you know, I mean, good for him. He seems to be in a good place with it. I mean, if I lost my dream job or my dream job didn't work out like that, I probably wouldn't be talking, giving any interviews at the moment. So, you know.
I think a lot of people kind of pile on kind of Brian Fuller, like, he's a fan of the show. Why would he want to leave? As if that he's like one of us. Like, yeah, he's probably the biggest fan as any of us, but he's still a professional at the end of the day. And sometimes decisions like that, you know, have to overrule your heart. And, you know, these things are kind of commonplace. And how many times in Star Trek history has someone been there, you know, for a season or two, or been there in the beginning of a process and then moved on? It's all too commonplace, really, you know. It's not an issue, really, for me in the grand scheme of things. I'd love if he stayed. I'd be over the moon. But ultimately, I'm happy that his influence is probably going to be kind of the cornerstone of that series going on for a good few years.
Yeah, I mean, to pull too much from it, I guess. But, you know, this is the guy who made Hannibal. And, you know, if he had any sort of inkling to take it in that sort of direction, that could, you know, to speak to Zach's point, could have fallen very flat with new audiences. I mean, Hannibal had a hell of a time trying to find an audience. And as superlative as that show is, but... If he feels that the salve for this wound is that he can continue down his current artistic streak of the way he explores things with another show, then yeah, he is in a good place.
The only thing that sort of scares me about this whole situation, the only thing which has made me sort of, you know, because a lot of people are like, you know, the plane has crashed into the mountain, and I'm like, you know, it's all good, you know, and I feel like, you know, maybe I'm being overly optimistic in some ways, but at the same time, I don't feel that way. I think I'm being reasonably optimistic. The only thing that sort of makes me nervous about the whole situation is one quote from Nicholas Meyer that he gave to IGN on their Star Trek podcast, whose name I forget. I'm sorry. Transporter Room 3, I think. I don't know. Anyway, Meyer says about the change, about, you know, Fuller leaving. He said, "Well, it represented a big change, and it certainly slowed down the process. Whether one thinks this is good, bad, or indifferent, that I can't discuss." That sounds a little ominous to me.
Well, I'm
going to wait until his cat weighs in before I go anywhere.
That's who
I'm waiting for.
Stella, oh, it's his dog. Stella, sorry. The Star Trek. Dog.
I follow that Twitter account.
It's the best.
Yeah,
I don't know. It's like a chicken or the egg thing. It's like, so was there delays and drama, and that caused him to leave, or did him leaving cause the delays? You know, because if they had. Because it seems to me they were accommodating him for a long time. He's like, we're going to launch in January. And then he's like, we need more time. Thank you, CBS, for giving us more time. We're going to launch in May. We're going to do this thing right. And then everything seemed to be fine. But was that just a Band-Aid, right? A short-term fix that just didn't hold, and everything just reverted back to the problems that were happening before, whatever those problems may be? You know, I don't know. So.
I think it comes back to, as I say, I'm not surprised, really, it's come to this, because he had so much on his plate, and when it was pushed back those few months because he was juggling so much as well. And I think CBS have done as much as they could to kind of help Brian Fuller, keep him involved. But ultimately, I think, as you were saying, it's maybe just a short-term fix that this workload with American Gods wasn't going to go away. And, you know, ultimately, it became a choice in the end that, do we delay further? Or do we have a kind of clean break here, you know, shake the hands and we both move on? And I think that's ultimately what's happened.
Yeah. All right. So moving on to the other big news for this week. There's some people who are going to be appearing on this here Star Trek show on television. Three people in particular: Doug Jones, Anthony Rapp, and Michelle Yeoh. So let's get started with Doug Jones, because he is playing a crazy alien guy, not at all surprising, who is the science officer aboard Disco. And yeah, Doug Jones, for those people who don't know, is an actor who's known for playing weird creatures and things like that. He's been in movies like Hellboy, playing Abe Sapien, and Labyrinth, Pan's Labyrinth, Pan's Labyrinth.
There is a difference.
Pan's Labyrinth. Very, very big difference on those.
He played David Bowie in Labyrinth.
He probably did. I mean, you know, he plays lots of... I mean, he's in Batman Returns. He's part of the Red Triangle Gang. Yeah, he's in. He plays the Moon guy, Mac Tonight in the Big Mac commercials, yeah. And yeah, you know, I mean, he's kind of known for that type of thing. So it makes
he's
sense
a live
to get
action
him to play
Andy Serkis.
That's a very good description of him. Yeah,
and for any fans of The Strain, he's the original master who turned the giant.
There you
and
go.
Anybody who watches The Strain understands what I just said.
He's in pretty much every Guillermo del Toro production mm-hmm. in some form mm-hmm. or another. So are you guys fans of Doug Jones?
Yeah, like for me, I most definitely am because I put up on my Instagram when he was cast that my go-to dance move over the past few years has been to pretend I'm the Pan's Labyrinth. So obviously everyone kind of knows if you're into those kind of movies where he puts the two hands over his his hands over his eyes and just kind of like that would be my dance move. So there's like loads of pictures of me kind of on nights out where it's like 2 a.m. and I'm just like pretending I'm the Pan's Labyrinth creature dancing away. So I put up on Instagram going, do you think I'm happy that Doug Jones has been cast in Star Trek Discovery without like a little montage of me doing those pictures? And he gave the picture a thumbs up. So I take it that he's happy that I'm happy. So we're both happy.
Excellent. What about you, Zach?
Yeah, I'm familiar with him from just a lot of the things you said. He's actually been on some recent episodes of The Flash. He played a metahuman on there. He was the Silver Surfer in the Fantastic Four, Rise of the Silver Surfer. That
oh my gosh, that's right.
Yeah, yeah, it was Lawrence Fishburne was the voice.
Yeah. In the trailers,
Fishburne was the voice of the planet eating thing.
Lawrence Fishburne was the voice.
No,
of the
Galactus
Silver Surfer.
Never said anything.
Yeah, Galactus was just a cloud. Mike.
Yeah, Galactus was a cloud, although you could argue that you saw Galactus'
shadow
in the very
so weak.
No,
like inside
I thought
the cloud
Fishburne
at the very end.
Was the voice of Galactus.
No, Galactus had no lines in that film. And I think there was a little bit of a controversy because Doug Jones, and he always gets dubbed over. He got dubbed over by David Hyde Pierce in Hellboy. He got dubbed over by Lawrence Fishburne in Silver Surfer. And I think in the trailers of Silver Surfer, they actually let him use his own voice, and then people were very surprised when it was Lawrence Fishburne, who has a great voice, and so does David Hyde Pierce. But hey, not everybody's David Prowse, right? We don't have to replace all their voices. Doug Jones is cool. And you know, as we'll go through the list here of these actors, it's cool that we're getting named people that were like, oh, yeah, I've seen him in all this. Because if you think at Star Trek series past, it's like, look at the Next Generation. LeVar Burton had been in Roots, and Will Wheaton had been in some films, as teenage films. And that's it. Everybody else is just complete unknowns. You know, unknown Shakespearean actor, right? Patrick Stewart. Yeah. So it's cool that you can point to all these things, and we know exactly what we're going to get with Doug Jones. And I'm very excited to see what kind of creative alien he inevitably plays on the show.
Yeah, yeah. What about you, John? You a fan?
Oh no, yeah. I am a fan. I'm a fan of any actor that understands how to use their body like an instrument. Like so many actors rely on their voice, or they rely on method acting, putting on or losing weight or anything. But like, here's a guy who blends so completely in the role that you see a picture of him and you're like, I don't know who that is. It's like Pan's Labyrinth. Oh, that guy's awesome. You know, like you love him. Yeah, exactly. You know, you love him, even though you never get to really know him. So I admire that. That's an actor who's really strong at his craft.
Yeah, I'm most familiar with him from, the Hellboy movies. I rewatched Hellboy yesterday, and, he is really good in that. And, I mean, the thing that really strikes me is that he's, very physical with his performance and everything, and he's good at, making himself seem alien even beyond the prosthetics and everything, and that's pretty cool. And it should be cool to see what he does in this, for sure. Okay, moving on to the next person, Anthony Rapp, who's going to play an astromycologist, I believe, which seems very specific, space fungus, right? And it's also been revealed that he is going to be the openly gay character, which Brian Fuller has talked about on the show. So, Anthony Rapp. He's best known as originating the lead role in the musical Rent, and then continuing that role in the feature film version by Christopher Columbus. And he's been in a number of movies and television shows, including a 2-episode stint on Steven Soderbergh's The Nick. So check that out. Zach, you a fan of Anthony Rapp?
I have seen the Rent movie, and I liked it. And that's the extent of my Anthony Rapp knowledge. So, I mean, yeah, it's okay, sure. That's all I have to add.
He really does. I mean, I think he's probably much bigger in terms of like stage productions than he is in terms of movies and TV. But yeah, what about you, Lee?
I'm sorry, but I've not seen anything on his rap sheet. No, he's actually like, it seems like most of Star Trek Discovery is actually in London just now. He's just finishing up, or he's in the middle of a stint there performing songs from Rent and some Broadway musicals. So he's there. One Night in Miami is just down the street, and then Brian Fuller's watching Harry Potter. So I'm sure there's some sort of crossover, that some little small London pub has the three, you know, Star Trek Discovery talents behind and in front of the camera, just sitting having a pie and some, you know, haggis, neeps and tatties.
What about you, John?
I think he's a good actor. I won't comment on Rent because I'm not a fan of the work. So
525,600 minutes, John. Come on.
That's how much time I have to go on about how I don't like that play, Zach. That's how long I have. Look, he's a good actor. He is. So I'm not going to hold the production against him, but you know, he's a good actor.
Fair to say, we're all more excited about Doug Jones, I guess, of these two.
Well, yeah, I did. By the way, for anyone who, you know, isn't familiar with, you know, their work, both Rent and Hellboy are on Netflix in America right now. So I watched both of them. You know, I rewatched Hellboy last night, and I watched Rent for the first time a couple days ago, and I actually enjoyed Rent a lot. You know, I mean. Let me temper that. I enjoyed it quite a bit, you know. I'm not going to say a lot, but I mean, I did think it was a good movie. You know, I thought it was, you know, well produced, and I thought that you know, the writing was good, and the performances, you know, everyone, including Anthony Rapp, and seeing him in that, because I mean, even though he was in 2 episodes of The Nick, I honestly cannot recall. Who he plays. He plays a doctor, which is kind of common on that show about a hospital. But, you know, I'm excited for him, because it seems like he's excited. Just like you were saying, Lee, you know, he's been rather active on social media. He took a picture of himself in front of his friend's Star Trek collection. And, you know, he seems to be interacting with the fans quite a bit and everything. So that's good. And
I'm sure that's going to be a meme come Christmas time, that we're all going to pose with our Christmas stockings as if we're Anthony Rapp. I did it myself the other day, and I just sat just to put my DVDs out on a table, and I just posed. You know, unfortunately, I was the only one in the house at the time, and I was determined to take this photo. So there's a picture of me looking really silly at quite a far distance away. yes.
And I do want to say that I hope that he is realizing the world that he's truly stepped into in terms of rabid fandom, because somebody did reply to that photo saying, "Is this just press? Are you really seriously going to go into this?" It's like, thanks for ruining the moment.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you for that. The guy's excited about his new job, and you just gotta do that.
You're just
to him.
A poser.
Yeah, right.
His comm badge comes right off.
So the other person who was officially confirmed to be in Star Trek Discovery is Michelle Yeoh, who's going to be playing the captain of another ship, the Shenzhou. And there's an interesting quote from an article today from Alex Kurtzman, because Kurtzman's been doing a bunch of press because they just released the first trailer for The Mummy, which is his new movie, which he's working on instead of Discovery. And in regards to...
they're all working on projects involving gods, aren't they?
That's true. In regards to Michelle Yeoh's role, Kurtzman said, quote, "I will not give you one detail about the show other than to tell you that I think that Michelle gets to play a part that has so many dimensions to it and is so perfect for where we want to go over the course of the season and maybe even beyond." Now, that's something, you know, Zach, you sent that to me this morning, and as soon as I read that, I was like, it sounds to me like they're setting her up for her own spin-off show, you know?
I disagree. I feel like she's a guest star, and this, you know, and she's not the captain of the Discovery, right? So we don't know how the show's going to be set up, so my assumption is she's a guest star. My take on that was, like, okay, we have big plans for her. Even though she's a guest star, she's going to come back next season. Like, we're not going to wrap. She's not a one-off, kind of one-season, one-story-arc guest star. I mean, I didn't immediately jump to spin-off. But, you know, you might be right. I mean, I don't know. I mean, they obviously, she's a great actress, and they're liking what's going on so far with her. So it's great. They have more plans for her. So be it. But I think we're way too early in the game to start thinking about spinoffs.
Yeah. I think the problem is that after Star Trek Beyond, it's almost impossible not to think of, whenever you see the word Beyond, it's associated with Star Trek. And, like, I saw that and I thought, oh, maybe they're going to put her in the future Star Trek yeah, movie in some exactly. capacity. They're just going to age her up. So, you know, things like that, just like Beyond is now kind of associated with Star Trek. And, you know, you hear anything, websites, Beyond, oh, that's kind of the Star Trek thing. And that was my reaction. Oh, maybe they'll put her in the next one.
Well, you know, whether or not Michelle Yeoh is in season 2 of Star Trek Discovery or in season 1 of Star Trek Shenzhou, one thing that she is in is Tomorrow Never Dies.
Yeah.
The second Pierce Brosnan James Bond film, which was directed by Roger Spottiswood, and which had an uncredited rewrite by Nicholas Meyer. And that's the movie that we're going to be talking about today. Okay, so now just a little background here, because the Nicholas Meyer thing is weird, because it's something that I always heard, because his name is on the novelization that Raymond Benson wrote, right?
Yeah.
Along with some other guys. So apparently what happened was there was a script written for Tomorrow Never Dies, and then Roger Spottiswood was hired to direct the movie. Then he read the script and was like, this needs some work. So he got 6 top Hollywood writers to come in and basically have like a story breaking session and try to, you know, solve the problems of Tomorrow Never Dies. And in that session, one of the people involved was Nicholas Meyer, because apparently he's Roger Spottiswood's brother-in-law.
That's right.
And also, Nicholas Meyer is also very good friends with Pierce Brosnan. They made a movie together, and they've, I guess, continued to be, you know, besties. So, Spottiswood chose Meyer to rewrite the script, which Meyer did, and then it was handed off to a couple of other people before eventually getting back to the original writer, Bruce Feierstein, who wrote the final draft of the script, and that's why Feierstein gets sole credit, because he wrote the first draft and the last draft.
At what point did they make the typo that changed it from Tomorrow Never Lies to Tomorrow Never Dies? Does anyone know?
Yeah.
Was it a typo?
It was
or
a typo.
Was it, really?
Yeah, 100%. I'm full of James Bond trivia, so prepare for an hour of nerding out. When it went to the printers, it was just as simple as someone put, it was meant to be Tomorrow Never Lies, then they put dies by mistake, and then they were like, oh, that sounds pretty good. We'll stick with that.
Tomorrow Never Lies is such a better title for this film.
Yeah, because that's the thing, isn't it? Like, tomorrow is the paper, and tomorrow lies.
Tomorrow Never Dies sounds like a canon movie from the 80s or something, right? But anyway.
There you go.
I guess Tomorrow Never Lies does make more sense for the movie, but I think Tomorrow Never Dies is the more Bond title, you know?
I agree. I think they wound up with the better title. I really do, because it's more, I don't know, it's more action-y. It's more Bond-esque, you know, dies, the threat of death.
It's so
90s
as well.
It is.
Tomorrow, and the song is brilliant too.
Also,
I like the song on the end credit. Yes. I like the version on the end credits way more than Cheryl Cole's version.
You're wrong, John.
I agree with you, John. Yeah. What do you say? Well, what do you say, Mike?
I like both of them, but I mean, what I like, I mean, I don't know the story behind this, but I could guess what happened. You know, the interesting thing about the song in the end credits is that, you know, that melody is woven throughout the score.
Yeah.
You know, yep. I'm guessing that they were like, oh, we've got Katie Lang to do this. And then they're like, you know, we could get Sheryl Crow to come in and do it. And then that's why it has two theme songs.
It's like,
well, I mean, Sheryl Crow's star was her stock was shooting through the roof right around that time. So, right. I mean, from a business decision standpoint, it was Sheryl Crow, you know, like, I don't know anybody that decides to go see a movie for who's singing the theme song. But, hey, maybe it worked. I don't know.
Well, but then you get it on the radio and everything like that. You know, that's something like that's in constant rotation, you know.
Like, that soundtrack will always be one of my favorites, because I remembered getting it when I was 10 at the time. I got the soundtrack, and I used to, like, put the music on, and there's a song on it called The Sinking of the Devonshire. It's a good, like, 7.5 minutes long, and I used to play that when I was, like, having my, like, Star Trek toys kicking around and everything like that. So Tomorrow Never Dies is, you know, I love this film, has so many connotations to my Star Trek fandom as well. So just imagine a young Scottish boy putting on a Tomorrow Never Dies CD and playing around with action figures. Can you think of anything more nerdy?
Well, okay, let's start with you, Lee. You obviously love this movie, and what is it about Tomorrow Never Dies that, you know, strikes a chord with you? Is it because of, you know, when you saw it, or do you think that it's legitimately a great Bond movie?
Yeah, it's a mixture of both, really. I think that, you know, like, for point of context, this is like 2:30, quarter to 3 in the morning here in Scotland. Like, I'm not gonna do this for, like, someone asked me to do this about whatever, I'm like, no. But it's like, Tomorrow Never Dies. Well, I've got to talk about Tomorrow Never Dies. It's like, I don't get this kind of opportunity. I love Tomorrow Never Dies. Kind of, I sent Zach, I'd written a blog about this movie, like, about a year and a half ago, 2 years ago. Tomorrow Never Dies was a film where it's so personal to me, because as a kid, I loved Star Trek, Batman, and Bond. And as a nearly 30-year-old guy, I love all three still. But, like, at that kind of stage in my life, I was a huge Bond fan. I was playing the games. It was on the TV all the time. I was buying the videos with some pocket money. And Tomorrow Never Dies came out kind of 97 here. And it's not like in America where an adult can take a kid to see a film. It, like, a 12-rated film. It's not going to happen. You've got to be 12 or above it. It changed when Spider-Man came out, but before that, never going to happen. Though, bizarrely, a few months later, my gran took me to see Titanic, no problems. So I was 10 years old, and I wanted to see no film more in the world than Tomorrow Never Dies, and I tried everything to get to that film. I begged my parents, no, you're too young. I remembered one day, like, one of my friends said, oh, I'm maybe going to go see it with my family. I'll let you know if we go. And I spent that whole Saturday thinking, is he going to call me? Is he going to come round? Are we going to go see this movie? Get 6 o'clock at night. Ooh, that showing's in about an hour and a half. We'll have to go now if we're going to go. And I remembered one day I just lost it. I was like, I need to see this film. And I remember it to this day. I went to my parents' bathroom. I took a Bible and I prayed on the Bible, please, God, let me see Tomorrow Never Dies. And I still didn't get to see Tomorrow Never Dies. So, you know, 19 years later, I'm an atheist. I think it all comes back to that moment. I remember the day I got it on, I could rent it from Blockbuster, and I was the happiest little boy. So I got to watch Tomorrow Never Dies, and I you know, I genuinely loved it. I got, like, this box set one Christmas, which had the video and a behind-the-scenes thing with Desmond Llewellyn and a book and art cards, and, you know, it was brilliant. And it's a film that makes me really happy because it's pure classic Bond. There's so many elements about it to enjoy. It's got a great Bond girl. It's got a great Bond villain. And it's got all the elements that you expect from a fun Bond movie. I mean, I'm actually, you know, raging about it because I work at a university. I logged into our intranet yesterday, and I went, film actor Jonathan Pryce stopped by the university for a Q&A with film students this week. Where the hell? Why would no one tell me this? And just like this, I'm just looking at the intranet going, okay, maybe he's coming. Maybe it's not that he has been, it's that he's coming. No, he's come. And I was like, oh my God, why was this not on the internet? Why was none of my co-members going, see that Jonathan Pryce guy is going to be at the campus today? So I could have hung out with a Bond villain, you know. And many of the times I've gone down to London, I always like to go see Bond locations up and down the UK. I've been to Skyfall. I've been, you know, to kind of locations here and there. And there's so many kind of Bond locations for Tomorrow Never Dies that you can find in London. I've been to them all. You know, same, like an art museum doubles as Russia. It's you know, it's brilliant. So I'm a huge Bond fan, and like Tomorrow Never Dies is that key stage of my Bond career. You know, whether it's using the soundtrack to play with my toys, whether it's praying to God to see the movie. I love this movie, and it will always hold a special place in my heart for what it was like 19 years ago to be me and breathe.
So Zach, as soon as the news about Michelle Yeoh broke, you were in the Babel conference, and like the third comment on there was you saying, "I call the Stage 9 episode about Tomorrow Never Dies." So why do you want to talk about Tomorrow Never Dies so much?
Well, that is a tough story to follow, Lee. I'm a big James Bond fan as well. Pierce Brosnan is my James Bond. Like, when you say James Bond, word association, Pierce Brosnan's face comes to my head. Mainly because I grew up playing GoldenEye. Like, I was in elementary school at the time. Me and my friends used to get together, play this all night long, all weekend long, and just grenades and Donkey Kong mode and paintball. Like, we play every iteration of the cheat code you can put into James Bond at GoldenEye, because it was one of the best, newest multiplayer games. You know, so you can have four people at once playing this. So, like, I was, like, eating and breathing James Bond in the late 90s as a kid, and I watched my dad introduce me to the old movies, you know, especially the Sean Connery movies. But still, you know, being that age, like, I gravitated towards, you know, GoldenEye. And GoldenEye, it's still my favorite Pierce Brosnan one. But I have a special place in my heart for the Pierce Brosnan movies. I feel like they get a bad rap, you know, because, yes, Casino Royale is brilliant. Casino Royale is my favorite James Bond movie, probably objectively the best of them all, from a purely, you know, if you just look at it as is with no bias and no nostalgia or anything, the best film is probably Casino Royale. But, you know, Pierce Brosnan had three good films. You know, people, Die Another Day is terrible, okay? But the other...
That's true.
The other three are good, you know? And I like all of them. And I feel like no one ever talks about Tomorrow Never Dies. No one ever talks about... I mean, people talk about GoldenEye, and people talk about The World Is Not Enough because Denise Richards was bad in it. And yes, she was bad in it. She was the weak link. But everything else in that movie is great. And then, of course, people talk about how awful Die Another Day was, and it was the Batman and Robin of James Bond, and they had to start from scratch. They'd been going for 40 years straight, and they had to start from scratch. So I just love the Pierce Brosnan era of James Bond. He had fun being James Bond. You know, he's one of the on-screen and off-screen. He's one of the few actors that seem to enjoy being James Bond. Everyone else seems to hate their time or quit and all this stuff. They had to, like, ask Brosnan to leave when they restarted, and he feels bad about having to go. Everybody else was like, "Oh, good riddance, I quit," you know? And that translates on screen. Like, I like how he enjoys being James Bond, you know? Roger Moore obviously enjoyed being James Bond as well, so he had a good run with it. But, yeah, Pierce Brosnan's great, and that's just a huge part of my childhood. Not as life-changing and monumental as Lee's experiences, but the Brosnan era of Bond is definitely the one that's closest to my heart and fandom. So,
you know, I don't want to out Lee here, but he sent me a private message after listening to last episode of Stage 9, where he was like, you're right about Die Another Day, when I was saying that it was a good movie.
I stand by it. It's half a good movie. I remembered, like, I saw World Is Not Enough at the cinema, like, 99, what a treat that was. And then when Die Another Day came out, I was old enough to go, like, all the way to the big city myself and see movies. And I went to see Die Another Day three times. I went on a date one time, took a girl. Mm. And, you know, it's half a good movie up until it gets to Cuba, up until it gets to Iceland. It's pretty good. There's a lot of good stuff in there. The sword fight's awesome. Mm. There's some good locations
sword
in London
fight is
you
awesome.
Can visit.
Sword fight is really cool. Yeah.
My parents always make fun of me when we were in London one time, and they've never let me live it down. We were walking along kind of the, you know, the South Bank, and I went, "See that door there? That's where James Bond goes downstairs to go to find the invisible car. Go take a picture of me next to this door. I've got these pictures. I'll share them with you in the thread or whatever." And I pose next to this random door in London. There's like, it's the visible car door. So it's just to the other side on the stairs is where George Lazenby poses in front of the Houses of Parliament on the lamppost. So, you know, Bond history is ever so close, just a stone's throw away.
Oh, that's so cool. Yeah. So, okay, before you get into your opinion about this movie, John, you know, let me just say that I agree with Zach and Lee about Tomorrow Never Dies. And, I mean, I think it's coming from the same place in a lot of ways. You know, Pierce Brosnan was my Bond, really. And, you know, GoldenEye, while I didn't think that it was a tremendously great movie, I think it's a good movie. I don't love it the way that, a lot of people love it. But I enjoyed it a lot, and I enjoyed the experience of watching it a lot. You know, I went to see it like the day before Thanksgiving with my best friend, and you know, that was a lot of fun. Like I'll always remember that screening for some reason. And you know, I had the Laserdisc as a kid growing up, and it was like the reference quality Laserdisc. I would always pop that in to see how my system was, or if I wanted to show off my sound system, I'd always pop in GoldenEye. And then when Tomorrow Never Dies came out, obviously I was very excited to see it. I saw it not on opening day, but the day after, because opening day I had to go see Titanic. I mean, come on. But I did watch it the day after it came out, and it really struck a chord with me because I thought that it fixed a lot of the problems that GoldenEye had. And, you know, like you guys were saying, it is classic sort of quintessential Bond. It had it checked all the boxes, like I was saying last week, and, you know, it did it exceptionally well. You know, I think that you know, the direction is fantastic. I mean, rewatching it again, some of those action sequences were so well done. You know, the photography by Robert Elswit is absolutely gorgeous. And, you know, a lot of the performances are great too, which we'll get into in a minute. But because of that, I really do think that it is the best of the Brosnan Bonds. And I like all of the Brosnan Bonds. I like all four of them. He's definitely my Bond too. And I think that aside from the Daniel Craig movies, this one is my personal favorite. So John, yeah, what do you think about this movie?
Well, I hate to disappoint everybody, but this is a middle of the road Bond movie to me. This is not stellar. This is not Spy Who Loved Me, Skyfall, Goldfinger, From Russia with Love quality Bond for me. This is more in I went into it saying, oh, no, I don't like this one. I remember not liking this one. And that is a fact. I'm the old man of this crew. And my first Bond was Timothy Dalton. Hmm. And I still love Living Daylights. And as I got older, I realized that License to Kill was terrible. And
I like License to Kill.
No, you're right, John. Yeah, Living Daylights is cool, and License to Kill is terrible.
They're both amazing. But,
I agree with you.
High five, Zach. But by the way, we were talking about titles. I mean, anyone know the story behind License to Kill and what the original title was?
Yes. Yeah, they thought that American audiences wouldn't. Yeah.
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 Bing.
Yeah.
Anyway. Okay. So I'm sorry. Jeff.
What does revoked mean?
GoldenEye pulled everything around, and I loved it. And my impression with it was I was sort of done with Bond actually very quickly after Tomorrow Never Dies, because it just didn't do anything for me. Because, and rewatching it this time, I think I've figured out why. Is I think you're right. The Michelle Yeoh's great. Brosnan is, you know, even though I dislike World Is Not Enough and Die Another Day a whole lot, he's always good. I agree with the statement that he obviously enjoyed being Bond, and it came through. He had a natural charisma that was great. I just wish he could have been in better vehicles. Like, I think it was just bad timing for him. But Tomorrow Never Dies, the villain is what sort of falls flat for me, because his motivation is just, you know, like there's nothing. Like Stromberg was, you know, and I know I've gone back now to Spy Who Loved Me, but like Stromberg was like, wow. And, you know, in terms of what a Bond villain was trying to achieve, it's very similar to like what Christopher Walken was trying to achieve, you know, in View to a Kill, where it was like, I'm going to corner the market on this. Really? You're going to start World War III over that? Huh. Okay. Like, you know, so it's like that's what sort of like makes it sputter out for me. All that said, yeah, it has a lot of components that are really good. I thought the motorcycle chase is a lot of fun to watch. I think that's really incredibly well choreographed. And that's, you know, that is a director just going for broke on an action sequence and saying, you know what, let's just do something crazy. And, you know, you got the helicopter cutting through the crowd and everything. Like, that's a great sequence to watch. And the only other thing that I'll throw out there is when they were sneaking around in the stealth ship, everything from the lighting to the set design actually reminded me of The Force Awakens. It looked a lot like going around Starkiller Base. Like, and I to the point where I actually looked up the credits. I was like, "Who? All right, there's got to be a connection here." I couldn't find one.
Yeah. So. Maybe that's just what Pinewood Studios just looks like, kind of big. That's like you, really, realistically, that's just the halls, and you just go around the corner and
007 and stage.
Yeah,
there you go.
40 years old today, so you know, chin chin to it. But like, I think you're really right there. Kind of like the villain in a way is very kind of weak, but really kind of it's that kind of 90s vibe that. Like media exploding that time that, oh, we're going to make newspapers. We're going to be rich from newspapers.
So, so dated. 10 years
can make a difference. And, you know, it really is kind of very 90s in that way. Like the internet's going to kill everyone and all these different things that we saw all through the 90s. And
it's on the mainframe.
Yeah. it's pretty crazy. I think Jonathan Pryce is really good. And I can see like it's heavily influenced that they say at the end, oh, that we're going with the story that we found him just floating. Kind of he'd fell off his kind of private boat. That was a callback to this media baron in Britain at the time, Robert Maxwell, who had taken like all the pension money out of like a newspaper, and then he mysteriously died not too long after, kind of getting caught out. So there was a lot of kind of ties into that, kind of inspired by Rupert Murdoch, kind of like Sky at the time in the UK. So like the villain kind of resonates a bit more in the UK, but I think in terms of kind of motivation, it's kind of a bit laughable now in retrospect that newspapers was
I want books, I want CDs. Like, come on, man. I like Jonathan Pryce. Before this, I only knew him from the he was in a series of Infinity car commercials, at least in the US. And he would be like the Q, and I don't know, my parents always said, oh, they should get John DeLancey to be this guy, because like, the new car was the Q or something. Then, of course, James Bond has a Q, you can tie it all together. But I guess people know Jonathan Pryce most today from probably, what, Pirates of the Caribbean, I guess?
For
me, it's always going to be Glengarry Glenn Ross. He's been in a ton of things, but that's always going to be my favorite appearance.
And my university. Oh, Jesus.
I mean, the obvious one, which everyone seems to be missing, I can't believe it, Brazil.
Yeah, no, he's great in Brazil. It's just I love Glengarry Glenn Ross so much that that's always where I go to.
Okay, I was just, he's magnificent. Like he's like the star of Brazil and everything. You know, yeah. I mean, okay, I thought for sure someone was going to be like, yeah. Anyway, okay, well, okay. So speaking of someone else who's in this movie, Michelle Yeoh.
Oh yes, that's why we're talking about this.
Yeah, she plays Wei Lin, who's the Chinese spy, who's basically 007's counterpart. And the two of them need to work together to take down Jonathan Pryce. So yeah, what did you guys think about Michelle Yeoh in this, Zach?
I mean, I think she's one of the best Bond girls for the fact that she doesn't immediately just fall into his arms and fall in love with him. Like they kiss at the end, but that's not. I mean, it's never a big deal. Like they never like truly hook up, so to speak. So she maintains her agency and she's her own character the whole time. Because in a lot of these Bond movies, you meet this tough woman and she's not the same as the other Bond girls. But then about 30 minutes in, right, they're just like, "Oh, James," and that's all evaporated. But she maintains her character the whole time. So I really appreciated that, and she could take care of herself, which was great, and she can hold her own. You know, that motorcycle chase, they're both struggling to take control of the motorcycle because they both think they're the alpha there. You know, neither of them defers to the other, and I really like that. And that is because a lot of them, and I think probably Denise Richards is the most famous one, saying like, you know, I'm not like every Bond girl, or every Bond girl really says that, right? But truly, in this movie, she wasn't, right? So I really liked her for that.
What about you, Lee?
Yeah, I would echo what Zach said. Like, I you get so tired of that bull every time there's a new Bond thing. I'm not like all the other Bond girls. Yeah, I've heard this all the time. But yeah, Wei Lin was definitely not like all the other Bond girls, and I loved her. And I'm kind of similar to, like, the reason I love your guys' show, this and your Star Wars one, for example, is that I approach the same thing with kind of Bond, that if someone's involved in a Bond film, I'm going to kind of follow your career and check you out in other movies. And Wei Lin, kind of her performance, Michelle Yeoh, I was like, oh, immediately taken by her. I thought she was a brilliant actress. So then I would go, oh, this Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, it looks great, but it's also got Michelle Yeoh in it. I'll check it out. And then I would kind of follow her career through Sunshine. And when she was obviously cast in Star Trek Discovery, it was like, amazing. Yeah, she's just so good in it. She's just badass. She's charming. She's funny. She's good looking. She's everything you would hope for in like a modern Bond girl that the 90s promised, and it delivered.
What about you, John?
Yeah. Well, I think the real strength of her performance, I mean, you know, the only thing I can add on is that I think the real strength of her performance is that the subtlety in the way that she plays it, there's nothing trumped up about, you don't feel like she's walking in with this bluster of like, I'm going to prove I'm as tough as James Bond. Like, she just walks in and she has enough of a presence that you just immediately buy that, you know, she belongs. Like, there's nothing about her character that is... That's like a false note where it's like, oh, well, they, you know, they're trying to beef her up here. Like, it seems like she's really, you know, she belongs. She can, you know, go toe to toe with anybody, and you don't ever question it. You don't say, oh, well, they wrote this way. You just buy her character and it just works.
Yeah. You know, I think the first thing that I saw her in was Supercop, which had come out, I think, a little bit before this. And, you know, she definitely, that kind of like, put it in my mind that she was, you know, like an action star, really, you know, more than anything else. And, you know, when I heard that she was cast in this, I was like, oh, well, that's kind of cool, because, you know, they're going to bring a type of action which really has not been present in Bond movies. And it's something that Brosnan doesn't do. You know, it's a different type of genre, in a sense. And, you know, she definitely gets a chance to kind of like show off her talents in that regard, in a few set pieces here. And I think the way that it was presented was really interesting, because while obviously, you know, Bond is the star of this movie and, you know, he's, you know, the best spy and everything, there are definitely moments where they make it clear that, you know, Wei Lin is better at some things, you know, and she, you know, can, you know, kick some dude's ass, maybe more easily than Bond can, certainly more gracefully, you know, I mean, that kind of thing. And, you know, that was the thing that I kept on thinking when I was watching it, more so than even when I was rewatching, you know, Crouching Tiger, was I'm like, wow, she is a total badass in this movie, you know? I mean, it really, really works well. And, you know, what you're saying, Zach, about, you know, the cliche and her, you know, really being one of the few Bond girls who can actually, you know, live up to that, you know, idea of being different from the others, is spot on, you know? And that's one of the reasons why I think that character works so well in this, and one of the reasons why the movie works so well. So yeah, I was a big fan of her in this movie, and rewatching it, I'm a big fan of her still. So it's exciting, you know. I'm excited that she's going to be in Disco, and hopefully she'll get to do some kung fu. I don't know, maybe if we're lucky.
No one will ever match Shatner for kung fu, so she'd be foolhardy to try.
Maybe we find out that she's the one that taught Captain Kirk how to fight.
Yes. The running leg kick. I want to see her do that on Discovery.
I mean, can you imagine seeing Michelle Yeoh versus the Gorn? I mean, come on.
Oh, that fanfiction writes itself.
Yeah.
All right. Well, any final thoughts on Tomorrow Never Dies, Zach?
Well, you know, if we had a spectrum here of like who likes it most to least, you know, of course, Lee would be all the way over here. And then you're probably right after him. And I'm more towards the center, you know, closer to John. Like, I think it's a good movie. I do, like, when I first saw it, I was like, I loved GoldenEye, but I have been so immersed in GoldenEye from rewatching it on video and playing the game. Like, GoldenEye, GoldenEye, GoldenEye. So when I saw this one, I was like, oh, this was different. And I don't know if I liked it as much. I don't know when I saw it when I was younger. But when I finally revisited them all, I was like, yeah, no, this is solid. This is good. This is different in a good way, you know. And, of course, you know, talk about the 90s. You had Terry Hatcher. The height of her 90s popularity in there. So that was cool to see her. So even like the secondary Bond girl, which is also always questionable in these movies, like, what are they going to do with her? You know, I thought she had a solid role, and you actually were, you know, sad when she died, because she had a pretty established history with Bond, so that was a nice take there. I love the remote-controlled car, like, you know, where Brosnan's in the back seat driving, and he's having so much fun being James Bond driving to this parking garage, you know? So just little moments like that always stick out to me. And, yeah, this is just a solid entry into the James Bond franchise, and, you know, I happily rewatch it with the other two good Brosnan movies, in my opinion, so.
One good Brosnan.
I'll take you to that shopping center where the parking lot is one day, Zach. When you're over in Britain, give me a shout and we'll go to this parking lot.
Oh, I can't wait.
What about you, Lee? Any final thoughts?
Yeah, I think that it's always one of those films, like it's not a perfect movie by any stretch of the imagination, but it's the same with all fandoms, whether it's Star Wars, Star Trek, that, you know, movies that kind of play a key role in your development, regardless of, GoldenEye, I think, is a superior movie, but Tomorrow Never Dies is just important and part of my story as being a geek, you know, how I got from that kind of fandom to that now. I'm sure even somehow the idea that I couldn't get to this film is why I go to the cinema all the time down the street. I'm sure there's some psychological blowback from that. But like, I will always look at this film and, you know, regardless of the flaws or anything like that, it's something that's hugely personal to me and I'm excited to watch every time. It's one of the Bonds. It's not up there, as John says, with The Sky Falls, The Spy Who Loved Me's, The License to Kills, The Living Daylights. But it's still like a great Bond. It's very 90s in everything it does, whether it's the opening credits, whether it's going down the kung fu route. It's a real true testament to Bond at the time. And people, I think, have been a bit unfair to the Pierce Brosnan era quite recently in that, it's not as good as the Daniel Craig era. Look how foolhardy they were. That was brilliant stuff for the 90s. Die Another Day obviously kind of falls short about those expectations, but they're great Bond movies of the time, as are the Roger Moore movies of the 70s and the Connery movies of the 60s. You have to base the Bond movies on the kind of the era they're made in. I think Tomorrow Never Dies, perhaps more than any of the Pierce Brosnan ones, sum up the 90s, whether it's in tone, themes, and ideas that they play with.
John?
Yeah. It's worth seeing. You know,
high praise from you. I was not expecting that.
Hey, I said at the beginning, like I was taken aback by my own reaction at the rewatch. I went in expecting to recreate my dislike of it, and then I went up. I was like, you know, this is actually pretty good. I kind of like this, but you know, it's middle of the road Bond for me. It's squarely, you know, it's just right in the middle of the pack. It's not going to be the first thing I turn to, but you know, if I'm going through and it's like Tomorrow Never Dies is on, and I'm flipping through, I'm like, yeah, okay, I'll stay.
Fair enough. Yeah, I mean, I am quite fond of this movie. I mean, it is really sort of the type of thing where when the Daniel Craig Bonds came along, I was like, okay, they've taken this up to another level. They've kicked it up another 3 or 4 quads per channel. But that doesn't mean that this isn't a good movie. And, you know, watching it is quite enjoyable. And, you know, Michelle Yeoh is awesome in it. And I want to watch it again now, you know? So yeah, definitely, you know, check out Tomorrow Never Dies. It's on Amazon Prime right now if you're here in the U.S. You can find it other places as well. And, it's worth taking a look at.
Yeah, it's on Hulu.
Oh, there you go.
Just so you know.
Yeah. Well, it's been fun talking about Tomorrow Never Dies today, but that's not all we're talking about here on Trek FM this week, so here's a quick look at some other stuff you might have missed on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, to the journey!
Yeah, that's what happened to the Equinox crew, actually. You know, we never did find out what happened to them, but in my headcanon, they're actually in little hamster wheels down an engineering making the ship go a little faster.
Faster, Mr. Lessing, faster!
Melodic Treks.
Now, both of those tracks make me think of Indiana Jones.
Yeah, I definitely think you're kind of right there. I'm not ashamed to admit that I have only ever seen the fourth Indiana Jones movie.
Dear Lord.
Meta Treks.
And that's the world of language that we live in. It's not this purely referential sense of language. Like when Riker says a minuet, he doesn't just mean, oh, yeah, that thing minuet that I can point to, whatever that is on the holodeck, right?
The 17th century French dance. Maybe he wants to dance.
Riker wants to bust a move.
Saturday morning Trek. When she did the psychic girl?
Yes.
Like that one where I was just like, really, Nichelle? Yeah. Like that is the direction that you want to go? Like,
they are putting a device in the warp control room. Oh, no.
Like, I was just, oh, man. But you could tell it was Nichelle. And I was laughing so hard at that. It was so much fun. And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So take a look at that excellent spot there by Zach Moore. Thank you very much for that, Zach. We appreciate your work on the previous.
Yes, I do all the previously on Trek FM spots, so you know that's me.
Yeah,
somebody's got to do it, and I do.
I felt like I submitted my first clip to you this week, and I was like, I made a really good point there, but I can't put that in. It looks like I'm favoriting myself.
Yeah, sometimes.
Yeah, you'll hear a lot of me talking about Standard Orbit on those clips if you haven't noticed.
Yeah.
All right. Well, check out these shows, especially Standard Orbit and Earl Grey, and discover what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out greatly and makes it easier for other listeners to find the show as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find us on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, or just download the MP3 from our website. All right, we have to thank our associate producers, Jeff Sutter, Chris Steftenagel, and Norman C. Lau. Thank you very much for your support. If you want to be like Jeff, Chris, and Norm, head on over to patreon.com/trekfm and become a patron of the network. That's patreon.com/trekfm, patreon.com/trekfm. You'll find all of our current goals and different milestone contribution levels, along with all the great perks we have for you. So head on over there and check it out. So speaking of Jeff, Jeff has been very generous and has donated some of his personal Star Trek collection to the show in order for us to give it away as prizes.
To a lucky listener who goes on over to iTunes and drops off a review for Stage 9, you'll be entered into a drawing for one of these fine prizes to be sent directly to you.
Yes. Okay, this contest is going to last a month, so we'll announce this on four shows from now. Anyway, in this lot, we have three items: a technical manual, a Star Trek technical manual from the 70s. I think all of these things are from the 70s. A set of blueprints, Star Trek blueprints, also from the 70s, and postcards, which are also from the 70s.
These blueprints, are they of the original Enterprise?
I believe they do, yeah.
Because Ken has been telling me that he saw some blueprints a long time ago and that the Enterprise had a cloaking device. So whoever wins these blueprints, please let us know if the Enterprise has a cloaking device in them. And my co-host and friend Ken Tripp would be very happy to know that. Thank you.
Well, you know what you should do is you should tell Ken to leave us a review on iTunes, and then you know maybe he can get these blueprints for himself. But yes, it's the Inside Star Trek blueprints set and the technical manual. It's the Star Trek Starfleet technical manual. It's got the United Federation of Planets logo on the front. It looks like a pretty awesome set, honestly. So these things can be yours. Just leave us a review on iTunes. If you want to contact us, go on to Twitter at Trek FM or go on to Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. Facebook is also where you'll find the Babel Conference, which is our listener forum. Tell us which episode of Stage 9 you want to be on. Like Zach. Yeah, just type the Babel Conference, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook. All right. So, Zach, where can people find you on the internet?
Well, here on the network, you can find me every week hosting Standard Orbit, our original series podcast, where we cover the original and new cast of Captain Kirk and Enterprise. I'm having a good time there with my friend and co-host Ken Tripp. We've been talking a lot about all of Star Trek, because the 50th anniversary, it gives us an excuse to talk about everything. We've been having a lot of fun across the streams over there. So I'm also around the Babel Conference, always pitching myself to be on other shows like this one, apparently. And then me personally on Twitter, you can find me at MoronZach, that's MoronZach. And I'm also the host of my own podcast called Always Hold On to Smallville, where we talk about each and every episode of That Young Superman Show. And we're on Twitter at AlwaysMallville with one S.
What about you, Lee?
It's 3:15 in the morning, so you'll find me in my bed almost imminently. You can find me on Twitter at Lee_Nostromo. You can find me slightly delirious now at Star Trek VHS. You can find me more coherent on Star Trek The Next Generation podcast, The Earl Grey. I think it's dropping as of recording today, so it should be out by the time this episode drops. And nice. Yeah, you can find me on all those different places, more awake.
All right, John?
All right, y'all know where to find me. Kessel Junkie on social media. You can also find me on Wars with Nerds. You can find me on Aggressive Negotiations. And you can find me on Great Shot Kid, which I do with a charming gentleman by the name of Mike Schindler on the Nerd Party Network.
Yes, and you can find me right there, and you can find me right here on Trek FM producing From There to Here, which is our daily rewatch of Star Trek, where we look at all 729 episodes.
You're almost done.
I'm almost done. I'm so close to the end.
You can taste it.
So close.
The end of your wit or will.
Oh, I remember when I did my last block, I was so relieved. I did it with Lee, and I said, Lee, I'm never watching another episode of Star Trek again.
I know,
I laughed at you, and then I was like, just the other day, I was like, oh, thank God I never have to watch
this. You know how it feels now.
Yeah.
It seemed like a good idea at the time, everyone, okay?
It was a good idea, and it is a good idea. It was a lot longer than we thought it was.
We're just having fun. It's a great reason to rewatch Star Trek. We had a lot of fun on it, definitely. We've all been on From There to Here, and it's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
For sure. You can also find me on Twitter at Mumbles3K, where I'm kind of slightly freaking out about Major League Baseball's uniform contract going to Under Armour. And yeah, Great Shot Kid. So I guess that's pretty much it for Stage 9 today. Thank you, Lee. Thank you, Zach.
Thank you.
John and I will return in...